Okay, gentlemen, we're going to have a very brief ceremony to break the silence. We've just completed 2.5, 2.75 hours, whatever it is, going to eat and come back in here. So I'm going to ask you all to stand directly behind your chairs. We've spent a lot of this weekend talking about our own egos. So I want us to break the silence by saying something to our own egos. And I want us to say it to that part of us that we love. It's part of us. So we want to say these words very lovingly, but very firmly. I want you to imagine that you're playing with your dog, and he's got a hold of the end of the rope, and he's growling, and you pull, and you pull, and you pull, and he just loves it. But it's time to go for a ride in the car. And you want him to let go. And you start and you go, "Rover, let go. Let go, boy. Come on, let go." And he isn't letting go. And so we say it louder and louder, but lovingly. We love this dog. And finally, we get firm. And we just go, and he lets go. He knows we mean business, but that we still love him. And I want us all, as loud as we feel like issuing this loving command to our own ego, to tell it to let go. Let go of our lives. You weren't supposed to have it in the first place. So just picture that, and as loud and as earnestly and as sincerely, on the count of three, say the two words, "Let go." 1, 2, 3.
Let go!
Have a seat. We're going to take a 10-minute break, chit-chat, we're going to do all that, but I have to confess something first. I did not make, through the entire period, being silent, and it's George Dunn's fault. About a half hour into it, I decided to walk by his car to admire it one more time. I mean, it's unbelievable, and I came over, and I was just captivated by it. It looks like it's brand new. For the first time, I saw the license plate, which says "Doo-Wah." And I looked and I just went, "Doo-Wah." So I just wanted to get that off my chest. Let's just visit for 10 minutes and then we'll have the two maestros. Okay, Lee. It's on. Okay, we've had our break, and I want to now come to the part on the program that says two maestros. And I got the idea for the title from a movie that I saw that was an Argentine movie called Tango. And in Argentina, that's the national craze, you know, the best tango dancer is like the best football player here. You know, and the kids start when they're this little. And they take something incredibly complex and make it look simple, which is the real art form, to take a dance. And life sometimes has been called a dance. And in the opening scene, they're in a nightclub. And there's the music and the band, and the owner is running around talking to all the VIPs that are there. And he goes by this elder gentleman, and he whispers in his ear, and the elder gentleman nods yes. And then he goes up, and he gets silence, and he says to the crowd, "I've asked the maestro if he will honor us with a dance." And you watch this awesomely and see how simple it is, and you're just struck with the beauty of the simplicity. And we've got two dancers tonight. And I've been struck with how hard they are seeking to make this simple. I relate to both of them. And and we're all trying to do that. And we're frustrated in our search for the ultimate simplicity in this dance of life, if we use this analogy tonight. And so the first, they're each going to do 30-minute dances. And the first of our dancers, and both of them are dear friends, is Scott Redman from California. Come on up, Scott.
All right. I want to thank Sandy for asking me to dance tonight. And I'm just overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed for the weekend. I've been running retreats for 10 years, and this is the first one I've ever been on. Which is a little pathetic. I've been running these and conducting these and doing these for a long time, and I've never been a participant. And I'm getting a chance to participate this weekend. The silence that we just did was an absolutely profound experience for me. I felt an incredible intimacy to the men who I was silent next to, you know. It's incredible to me how much I use language to keep people away from me. It's just astounding to me, and I was shocked by it, by the depth of it, you know. And then there are a couple of people who I just couldn't even go near because we just can't stop talking to each other. Steve passed me and just went, and Brent and I too. We really soak it up when we're together. I'm here with this incredible group of men. Bob and Sandy have had profound impacts on me, and it has nothing to do with them. God's just played a song through them that I've been able to hear in a really big way, and both of them have changed my life, and I know it's not them. I know it's not them. For me, it's them, you know. And how many times in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, a guy tells you your favorite speaker, his favorite speaker, and it's a speaker that you have... When he talks, you just want to see a wrecking ball sweep through the room and just take the guy away. You know, he's just the worst speaker. People are just, you know, should be throwing nooses over the rafters while the guy's talking. And long ago, I learned in AA to not say to the guy that he didn't like the speaker, was to say, "Oh, well, you got that song played to you that way." I was overwhelmed with what Sandy did. With the exercises, you know, it's a terrible thing what has been done to men through early separation from mothers and all this stuff and being told to shape up and buck up and act like a man. And I want to tell you, I think it's horseshit. I'm the father of two men, and every time I've done that with them, I've squandered their time and their energy. I've helped neither one of them be a man in that way. At any time, I can honestly tell you. And so when somebody gets exposed or somebody acts in a way that could be marked feminine or the worst, because as a man, I'm not afraid of shame. I'm shame phobic. To be humiliated or embarrassed or ashamed is the worst moment you could possibly have. You know, when I got smashed in the face by a baseball, my mom came out to help me, and through gritted teeth, I said, "Get out of here. Get out of here." And you know what? That probably wasn't the worst thing to say to her, because I was going to pay a terrible price for that. And I got to tell you, I'm in AA. I don't have to pay a price for that. I don't have to pay a price for it. I am a part of the connective tissue of Alcoholics Anonymous. This thing that has allowed my alcoholism to be buoyed above the horizon as a real piece of business for 21 years. Not once has it sunk below the horizon and become a complaint. We were talking about that earlier. The things that I've continued to suffer from in AA have been complaints. They remain complaints. My wife acts like her a lot. And exactly like her. So, like, she's got a book, How to Act Like Me. And we were having a conversation, and I finished, I think, 15 of her sentences in a row. And she said to me, she said, look, this is what I want to do. I want to take a shot at an entire sentence. And if I run into trouble in the middle of it, I'll indicate. I'll make a sign, and you just jump in and finish that sucker. But if I look like I'm in good shape, let me go through the whole thing. I want to take a shot at a whole sentence. And I have earmarked myself as the non-controlling one, which is really great. It's unbelievable. Our older son, when he graduated high school, elected to not go to college. He elected to go to Chiapas, Mexico, and work with the Zapatista revolutionaries. I felt he made this choice because I didn't seem to be terrified enough. So he went and he did that. And when he came back, my sponsor pointed out to me when I was weeping with terror. And he said to me, he didn't argue with me. He did the thing, they say it in the book over and over, don't argue with them. Don't argue with them. Make the demonstration, invite them along, and keep going, you know? And he didn't say, it's not scary, because the Mexican military is such a warm, inclusive group of people. He didn't say, it's not scary. He didn't say he's not in danger. He was in terrible danger. He said to me, what if this is the greatest thing he ever does? And I would have snatched it back from him. Now, I don't know if it's the greatest thing he'll ever do, but man, he came back from there fully cut cloth. He came back whole. Yeah, yeah. And he came back, he was here a couple months, and he started filling out applications to go to undergrad school, which we were very excited about. My wife was kind of felt, I think, that he wasn't doing it fast enough, and she was kind of nudging him. And he was 18 at the time, and he looks up at her and he says to her, do you actually think that your anxiety benefits me in any way? And my wife, like, looked at him and went, oh, I was kind of hoping, you know, I was kind of... Part of the plan, you know, and it doesn't. And I've been so free of anxiety this weekend, so just willing to be here, allowing myself to be taken care of, willing to listen to the music. Well, I know that there's no. Isn't this so funny? There's no rest for me in AA if I'm not seeking. There's no rest for me in AA if I'm not seeking. And the guys, through my sobriety, have said, you're an idiot, shut up, if your lips are moving, you're lying, you don't know anything. I've just, for 21 years, I've stayed away from them. And I continue to stay away from them. And it's been a real good thing for me. We started a progressive nursery school some years ago. My wife is a progressive nursery school educator and a member of Al-Anon for some 21 years, and I've watched this sort of greenhouse, this hothouse of love that she's developed, doing so many of the things that we see here with families being just snatched back from the gates of disaster, you know, and watching her just, you know, I was talking to a guy before. One of the things that's been on the table for me in the last couple of years, and is still, and it's a wonderful and at times difficult thing, is to find the line between playing God and being irresponsible. You know? And, man, it's tough. It's tough. Because I can mandate just about any behavior. You know, if I get granular enough with it and, you know, get enough people going like this, I can charge in. For a long time with men I sponsor, I was so erring on the side of not playing God that I stopped having a lot of very intimate relationships. That, and I had to take a look at that and go, okay, if I kind of move in the different direction, can I do it not as an instructor, not as a pedant, but as somebody who's really interested in their life, wants to be more involved, wants to go do stuff or hang out or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's been really rewarding. Also, some of the relationships I had didn't make it through that transition. You know, nothing can stand the light. When you hold it up to the light, it can't stand it. When it's held up to the, and I also find that once you start telling the truth, you can't stop, which is really annoying. One of the parents at Nancy's school had an idea for a logo for the school for the artwork for the stationery. And he came back to her, which something I thought was really benign and very sweet. It was a rendering of the children during dress-up, wearing wizard's hats and all this stuff that they put on. And my wife said, absolutely, there's no way I would ever use this. And the guy said, why? And I said, you're intruding in their most intimate moment. You're exposing them in the flashpoint where they trust enough and feel comfortable enough to give themselves over to this thing. She said, and the guy's kind of like going just now, she said, I might as well take a picture of you talking to your therapist and publish it on your stationery. And it was so interesting to me, because when someone breaks anonymity or there's crosstalk, I feel that there's a disruption in my most intimate, in the most intimate moment, you know. About 20 months ago, I had a back thing that was bugging me for a long time, and it's just again one of the things I loved about what Sandy did is we have a disease. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard it. It's mental, physical, and spiritual, and I let go of the physical a lot. I pay a lot more mind to the mental and the spiritual than anything else. And the result for me was, I thought I had a back problem, and 20 months ago, my wife and I are sitting in a doctor's office. I got to tell you what happened before this. My back problem was bad. I was on a trip with Steve, and I couldn't do anything, and I went to the doctor, and I go into this doctor's office, and they take a picture of my spine, and I'm with this Russian woman who's got a heavy Russian accent, and she takes a picture of my spine, and she puts it in the light box, and she's looking at it, which it's completely incomprehensible to me, and she looks at it in this heavy accent, and she goes, oh, no. I said, oh, no. What do you mean, oh, no? What does that mean? And she said, disc gone. No disc. Disc gone. And I said, well, how does such a thing happen? And she said, bad luck. I go and I see the doctor, and a doctor doesn't even ask my name. He says, we're going to open you up from the front, put your vital organs to the side, and have a cardiologist there, make sure you stay alive, work directly into the spine, we'll get some, you know, cadaver bone that, you know. And by now I'm going, la, 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 la. I go through this whole thing, and I'm like going, I'm going to make a mental image of this because I'm never going to see you again, man. And I went, thank you. And I gathered all my stuff. At any rate, another doctor a couple months later, and he puts my stuff in the box. My wife's standing there, and I'm standing there, and he said, you're on the brink of losing the use of your legs and having kidney failure. And then he asked me this thing that was awful and very embarrassing and wound up being very good for me. He said to me, how did you let yourself get so sick? I'm 20 years into this deal. I spend a lot of my time with other guys. I would never let a guy get that sick, or I would certainly never sit by quietly while a guy got that sick. Why was it okay for me to get that sick? You know, and so much of the work that we've done this weekend. So much of the song that we've sung. And it's such a dangerous thing, you know. It's something that I was so... I'm glad I was reticent to look at it for a long time in AA. I'm one of those guys that didn't put himself on his nine-step amends. A lot of guys do. I have no problem with guys who do. I've been very scared and, you know, about this thing of taking care of myself. Very scared by it. Very reticent to do it. You know, when a guy I sponsor says he's working on himself, I want to go, step away from yourself. Step away from yourself, sir. Because it's one drunk talking to himself, and it's not, you know, there's not a lot of novelty there. But this thing, and it's happened this weekend in a way that's very doable for me, very acceptable, to show and express that kind of love for myself. I don't know that I could have done it real new. I was scared. I was just scared. I didn't know how to do it, you know. And so after the doctor asked me that question, and I sat down and I had to write some resentments against myself for being embarrassed and for not doing that, and resentment against my wife for accusing me of faking pain for 10 or 15 years, although I judge no woman. I did give her a hard look, and she did hang her head a little bit. And the fact was I didn't bring the whole package. I didn't bring the whole package. I grew up in a situation where you just didn't ask for help, and if you did, boy, you really got, it wasn't good. It wasn't good. And if you were really badly injured, you got taught a lesson, and it wasn't good. So to bring the whole package would, for me, to be as loving as I am to you, as I tend to be with you. I so took so much pleasure in our forgiveness exercise the other day. I loved when he talked about moving this person from the head to the heart. I can't kill people when they're in my heart. I don't think people murder other people. I think they murder objects. I think they have to be stripped of their humanity before you get to march people into the showers. I don't think that happens people on people. I think that happens people on objects when they get vilified, when they get objectified and compartmentalized. And I know that I've done that, you know, in my own way. And I wasn't able to pull back. Eckhart Tolle, who's one of the people we've been talking about this week and made references to, and another great spiritual teacher Bob took me to, named Anthony DeMello, talk about being the watcher. Taking a step back and doing self-examination. And it's a lovely thing. I've taken it pretty far with some of the guys I sponsor. One of the guys I sponsor called, he was vilifying himself for being an idiot. He's got this new job. It's a high-tech job. He's got to email this thing out. So we talked about being the watcher and pulling back and taking a look at that. And then we came up with that he would email it to himself. He'd be the watcher. and see what, you know, if he opened the email and went, what a jerk, what a moron, why did we, you know, and it's so funny when we get into that state. I said to the guy, I'm sure your company went down a list of guys and said, of all the people we know, I think this guy could wreck the company, let's get him on board. He could really put us into crapper, let's get this guy, give him good benefits and get him signed up. And I had to, once I was able to say, oh boy, poor sweet Scott, you just don't know how to do this. You have to be mindful of the fact that you don't know how to ask for help. You don't get to not ask for help. Not because you think you deserve it. If we wait till you think you deserve it, we might be really old. Although that might happen, but don't stop waiting for that. Take care of yourself as you would one of your brothers, one of your sisters, one of these men who you love, one of these guys who you've seen come in looking like they've been shot out of a cannon and put, you know, and put a life together. That incredible thing that we see, you know, when we see that thing in the guy's eyes, and particularly, it's so thrilling when you are with a guy who actually understands the gravity of the opportunity that's been afforded him. Man, that is incredible. That is mind-blowing. And sometimes it happens early on, and it's really fun, and sometimes it happens later on. And one of the things I'm I'm so pleased that I've allowed myself to do is I love our literature, I love our program, I've been involved diligently for a long time, and I do know another one of the teachers that we've got on the table is a guy named Alan Watts, and he's wrote a book called The Book. If you haven't read it, it's really a fantastic book. And in it, he talks about something that as a father is very meaningful to me, and as a friend it's meaningful to me. He says, what's the book you'd like to give your kid? If you could give your kid one book, you give the person you love one book. And he says, I'd like it to be the book that's the gateway to all the other books. I'd like it to be the doorway, the conduit, the tunnel. You know, I believe for me at this point, I don't believe, I know it because it's happening to me, that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the gateway to all the other books. And it hasn't diminished my experience of the steps, my ability to apply them and teach them and share them. It's absolutely enhanced it. And something I've seen with, I've experienced it, and I've seen it appear with many people later in sobriety, particularly those who have had a drink, is they go over and over the same material until it falls apart in their hands, until it feels like a mouthful of dust, until it just feels like that's all there is. And Sandy said it earlier, he quoted Jung, and it's a beautiful idea that a spiritual experience is not enough. That if that spiritual experience is not then taken to a spiritual community that can be the shepherd of that, that can help reinvigorate it and reignite it, that that of itself is of itself. And every time, you know, I've gone through periods in AA where people didn't do the inventory the way I thought it should be done and this, and I became over sober for a period of time. And over sober is ugly. It's ugly. It was ugly on me, and it's ugly when I see it. And I know, for me, I believe that I know what's wrong with the world. That the illusion of separateness is killing us. I don't know if it'll eventually kill us. I have high hopes. Some people say, well, why bring a kid up today? And my response is, there's never been a better time. When was a better time? The 1400s? That was great. When was a better time? 1939? When was a better time? There's never been a better time. You know, the danger has become more franchised. It's not, you know, there's nothing we can hit out of the park with a, you know, with a bat. And I don't think there's ever been a better time to be part of a spiritual community. And we, you know, I've felt this at times. I know that we have no monopoly on spiritual experience and spiritual development. I also know that the 12-step approach and to be free as possible of resentments, fears, and sexual misconduct, if you can do that, if you can try to apply that, if you can move closer to your Creator so that he'll reveal himself to you, that this is an incredible way of life. Some years ago, my family and I got really scared and really beat up. We were at the epicenter of the Northridge earthquake. And I had an incredible experience after the quake. A woman at an out-of-town AA conference came up to me and said, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, well, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. And I have no interest in staying sober in that world. I have no interest in staying sober in a world where I've got a God saying, get him, get the Redmond boy. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him, get him. Get him. Turn his wife to salt, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye. Get him. It's like God is some deranged game show host, you know. It's boils for you. We'll key your car. You're due for a rash, right? And you'll figure it out. There's a reason. You'll figure it out later on. For me, to anthropomorphize God, to lend a personality and an intention to God, I believe that the word God for me is so woefully inadequate to express what we're talking about, you know. And when that happens, when I'm being taught a lesson, it's a very tiny world. It's the way I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, like a very tiny, very painful paper cut. Something very small and very, very hurtful. My son Micah and my son Jesse were injured terribly from growing up in an alcoholic family. And as our book talks about, the recovery for them, as the recovery for all of us, has been extraordinary. It's been fraught with difficulties, with Zapatistas and all sorts of adventures and different stuff. I said to Michael when he was 15, I said, the difference, biggest difference between you and I right now is you're willing to die for what you believe in, and I'm not willing to die for what you believe in. When he was about 19, he was babysitting for this couple on the program, and the guy said to him, what do you think of your dad talking in AA? And Micah said, I'm not a member. I'm happy for him, but I don't really care. He said, all I can tell you is since I'm a very, very little boy, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have taken very, very good care of me, and never once has any of them demanded that I believe what they believe. Wow. I mean, what an incredible shining star in the midst of so much spiritual propriety, so much ownership, this illusion of being separate. And as the ice has fallen away from my heart, one of the things I really experienced during the silence today was feeling like I was holding my kids, just really feeling like I was holding my kids. You know, and I need to call them both and tell them that I'm sorry for when I rushed them and I'm grateful for when I didn't. I really am. I really am sorry for when I rushed them. And I'm so grateful because I know sometimes I didn't, you know. So if this is your first retreat or your 80th retreat, I just thanks for being my brother and thanks for sharing this real incredibly intimate time, you know. It's great to finally go on a retreat. And now I know why all these people have liked it all of this time. So I love you all very much. Thank you.
I guess you all understand why I was so much looking forward to the first dancer. And he's further away, and I don't get to see him as often, but we talk on the phone a lot. And our second one is somebody that I spend a lot of time with, and we've done a lot of dances together. I'm not sure who's leading. You're going to give the humility talk, okay. I may be old, but I'm not slow. I can't tell you how much I love this man. I just can't. It's just wonderful. This is my dear friend, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Bob Bazans.
St. Paul, we don't want to give Minneapolis a bad reputation.
I'm from St. Paul. Yeah. This has really been very nice. And when I said who leads, Sandy leads. One of the things I've always loved in AA, and many of those of us, I think, that are active do, is you want to be around the big guys, the guys that have more sobriety, and Sandy was one of those men for me. And the idea that I'm able to share stuff with him today is a thrill. a minor resentment. I was asked to give a talk at an AA group in Las Vegas last weekend, and I was looking forward to it. And then I got bumped because Sandy came. And they said, well, it's Sandy's birthday, which was Friday. My birthday was Sunday. I mean, I thought... what I like best about Sandy, and he's made a difference, a big difference for me in the last couple of years especially, and what I think most of us are experiencing this weekend, he has an intellect and a gift for language that is astounding. Some of the men who have been the most important people in my life in AA are storytellers, be it Chuck or Bob White from Texas, they were. And because so many of the things we really talk about, you really can't contain in language, storytellers convey something that most of us can't convey, especially when we're using our intellect. And we are an oral society. I mean, we have shared, I mean, almost everything we do, we tell by story. And Sandy's, you know, one of the best at that. What I like in addition to what he does is there's a gentleness this weekend. There's no agenda. You know, if I would have scheduled this thing, I would have thought that I should have talked twice as much as Sandy's talking this weekend. That's just the way my head worked. Regardless of that, I could not fill the time effectively. I just would have... we would have gone for quantity. And... it's... and I have this split thing. The thing that is clear to me when I listen to him, and the thing that Vernon and I were talking about, that is, when Sandy talked about God is loving you when you're sinning, boy, I mean, do I need to woodburn that on my forehead? I mean, it is, because I don't believe that. Not bone deep, I don't believe that. And I need to believe that. I think some of the changes that we have to make later in sobriety, we need compassion. None of us are missing insight. None of us are missing information. None of us are probably even missing what to do. I mean, if you've got 3 or 4 or 5 years and you've been a fairly serious member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that old thing that I sometimes do when someone comes over to the house and dumps the load, is I say, quiet down, close your eyes, pretend I came to your house and dumped the same load. You know, tell me what to do. They always know. You know, but usually none of us have the power to do it. And Scott, so cruelly at lunch today, pointed out something to me that I said to him a few years ago, which I think is really unkind. Because right now I'm not able to do it effectively, and he is, you know, so it's kind of nah. In the world of spirituality, I'm probably an 8 handicap, and lately I've been playing to about a 23. And that's the way life is. You just, you know, it's just the way life is. You get periods of time where you're more on top of your game. The good news is that sometimes when you're playing to a 23, you're more... focused, and you know you need more help. There's a little of that in the midst of it. I have this dual thing when I listen to Sandy. I am as stimulated as I could possibly be. He's putting into words things that I've been trying to put into words for a while, and he's doing it better with a little bit more clarity than I have been able to do. Vernon, my friend from Naples, was supposed to be together last week, and his mother died, and he was telling me about his dad, and he mentioned that his dad's actually kind of doing better than Vernon, you know, or he's more stoic, or he's, you know, he's more accepting. And what I said to him is, I said, the previous generation was more accepting. They were not surprised when difficult things happened to them, okay? Our society has changed so much. The environment in which we live. When I came in AA in '67, the world supported recovery. Today, it supports addiction. I mean, in every kind of classical way. We have just, you know, in my father's generation, people might buy a house for $15,000 and live in it for 40 years. Raise your hand if anybody wants to do that in this room. I mean, there isn't, that is not today what we do. You know, they'd buy a car and drive it for 10 or 12 years and get a new car. It was a very big deal. You know, for those of us that can afford it, we don't want to do that. You know, it's 2-3 years and we, you know, I mean, it is, we have become so, you know, we measure ourselves. I'm a deeply shallow materialist. You know, we are what we have and buy, you know. I mean, we are inundated and television, you know, and by commercialism. And the message of commercialism is you're not okay. I mean, you'd be okay if you had the right watch, the right car, the right house, the right body, the right money, the right job, the right kids, but you're not okay the way you are. I mean, and it's subtle. I mean, they are doing studies right now on odors. You know, they put certain odors in stores that they think stimulates buying. I mean, the level of sophistication to get us in the game to buy, which is what the agenda of the ego, what he's talking about, the ego is into wanting. It's a wanting machine. And the thing that we need to know about that, it is insatiable. It is not only a wanting machine, it has no condition of satisfaction. It is an endless black hole. You can throw... I got a buddy that just had a kind of a midlife crisis recently. And a lot of the guys in the room are about the age where some of us might have a midlife crisis, which is what? And in some ways, it's the 50, you know, I don't know, late 40s to early 60s guy who realized that he hasn't climbed all the mountains he wanted to climb. And the mountains he has climbed have not made the difference that he thought they'd make when he climbed them. And your life feels somewhat hollow at that point. The message everywhere in the world today is the answer is external. And if you're suffering, something's wrong. You've done something wrong. Life should not be difficult. Life should be easy. Which, you know, if you read Scott Peck's book, the first line of the book is life is difficult. And most of us don't want to be in relationship with that statement. The religion of today is psychology. We want to know more about how we feel and get insight into, you know, this rat race that is going on in our heads. Psychology is not deep enough to answer the questions. As Sandy so wonderfully put, our problem is separation from God. One of the boats of mythology that has carried the fundamental message of man is the fall of man. You know, and most people who today try to relate that, you know, Adam and Eve, the fall of man, that's mythical story that we have in our, in, you know, our Bible. That fall was a separation from God. And I really believe that that is the mythical story, and we're trying to get back. You know, it's a journey. And if there's anything I've discovered over the last number of years that has consoled me, and I have difficulty, sometimes I'm more consolable than others, is it's a journey of coming home. It's not a journey of becoming anything you are not. The process of finding God is becoming who you truly are inside. So most of us, if you were to take, you know, the people I know in the room, I look around at you, and our wise brothers and sisters and bosses would say, God, you're so different. You're not like that same man at all when you came in here. But most of us know we're the same guy. We're actually becoming more who we have always been than becoming something different. When I first came in, I wanted to become the people who I was, my sponsor, other people that excited me, which has not happened. I'm coming home. And the thing I like about that is that seems more accomplishable than the other agendas I have. I have the other noise in my head. I have this deep noise in my head that I'm not okay and it's not okay. I don't know where I got it, you know, I don't know whether it was my church, or society or whatever the hell it is, but that's my mantra. I have this, thought going through my head when I'm not careful, I'm not okay, and it's not okay. And that's not okay. I mean, I really am tired of that ego-based thought that grabs me as I go through. I really am about as tired as that as I could possibly be. It eats into my gratitude and it eats into my joy. I don't know if it was Sandy that said it or the book. Oh, Sandy in his handout, said, if you're not joyful, you've got the wrong belief system. If the system that you're working on and the faith that you're operating under is not producing some happiness and joy, take a look at how you're doing it, because those are the fruits of contact and relationship with the God of your understanding. A lightness that a lot of us have trouble maintaining. The process of finding God is a process of removal. Sandy's going to talk about tomorrow, I think, when he talks about that all we ever do in Alcoholics Anonymous is let go. I believe that we have no place to go, that we are intact, whole, and complete, that we were a perfect sphere, perfect crystalline magnetic sphere that got dragged through the junkyard of life. And when we showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, it was about this tall, full of metal crap that it had picked up going through the junkyard of life. And that in the process of inventory and in the process of surrender, we pry piece by piece off of that big ball. And somewhere along the line, a little ray of light escapes, from the perfect sphere that's in the middle. And little by little, we keep removing some of that to come to the essence of who we are. My spiritual advisor said, I remember the first time I went to EST, which was a self-actualization program that probably people on the West Coast are even more familiar with than I. And over a period of 7 or 8 years, I did some work in EST. I remember I went to a thing, and a guy said to me, he said, you are God. I said that in the room, and I'm a Catholic, and that was one of the most offensive things I'd ever heard. I know who God is. I know what he looks like, where he lives, and, he's our guy. And but a few years ago, 10 years ago or something like that, my spiritual advisor said, you are God. Everything you are is God. Now, you're not everything God is. But he said, if I took a cell out of your hand, he said, everything that cell is would be Bob Bazant's. Now, that cell is not everything Bob Bazant's is. And I believe, different faiths have used different words that were made in the image and likeness of God. And don't most of us, when we're at meetings or when we're doing this sort of thing, when you hear stuff, don't you feel like you've just known it all your life? Some man said once that there's an idea that no one can learn what they don't already know. And I don't know if that's true, but don't you get the sense when people say something in AA, it's just kind of the right thing that floated through the meeting? Your soul just kind of goes, oh, yeah. Now, you've never had that thought. You've never, as a piece of information, it was not something that you had access to. And you just... No, you just know. It's so. There's a knower. And when we plug in to our contact with the power greater than ourselves, we're plugging into the mainframe. I mean, most of us have been walking around with a handheld computer, with a little blueberry, thinking we're, so we're checking that, and that's our, that's our brain, walking around. And what we really want is our intuition. We want a different access. And intuition gets to, it includes thinking, but it's heart connected, it's mainframe connected. There's a way of knowing in that place that is not just intellectual. So it seems like we have a choice. When your ego and intellect are in charge, you've got this 16-year-old kid who's kind of running the show, and it feels different, it feels separate, and it has an agenda. It wants to be right, make other people wrong. It wants to dominate and avoid domination. It wants to avoid pain and seek pleasure. And it's, and there's a lot of subcategories that go in there, and that's its agenda. And when we're God-centered, as Chuck We talked a little bit about Chuck this weekend. One of my favorite things about Chuck, a couple of favorite things, but one of the things is he said you can either have a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or you can have a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. And when you have a God-centered life, and when you're plugged in, it's okay. It's a different context. As Sandy so beautifully talked about, it looks different. Everything looks different. And we can, and it's so different that you can physically see the change in people. I mean, you're working with a new guy, somewhere in the first month or 2 months or something like that, he's not the same person. The light comes on in the eyes. Not the same person. He physically looks different than the way he looked before. I think some of the men in this room, when they go home, are going to look different than the way they did before they came in this room. I really believe that there's going to be some letting go, some release, some sort of contact with the thing. My spiritual advisor has been kind of haranguing. I went to him 10, 12, quite a few years ago and asked him to be my director, and he's asked me what I wanted, and I said I wanted to be less materialistic and more loving. Within about a year and a half, I went through bankruptcy. I lost enough money to burn a wet elephant, and it was a very, very, very tough time. I thought I was dying through that process, and I had to learn who I was with money and without money, and it was a very tough time. We laugh about that today. I would not trade the lesson that I got through that process for the money, And today, money is still one of my main issues. I've got four or five issues that I don't do very well with. And it seems like we leak in the same place. It's like a hernia or something. Like we have the stomach, the muscle wall isn't, it's going to be weak. It isn't like you can't get over it, and it isn't like you can't deal with it. But we have a tendency, if you're a man who is significantly angry, that may be something that you might have to have an eye on once in a while throughout your entire life, just because of your personality. It will not dominate your life or do that. And one of the things I said to my spiritual advisor, and I don't know if it's true, and I'm trying to, I said, look, you're 75 or 8 years old, 72 years old. I said, a lot of this stuff is easy for you to say. You don't work. Your kids are gone. I'm not joking. I mean, and it was really kind of a confrontive, not very nice thing to say. I mean, and what he's saying to me is, you're right. Your work is absolutely in your way. He said, it is more difficult for you, because of the work you do, to live a spiritual life. And it may be because I do it so poorly, but there is a sense of conflict. There is a sense of high velocity. There is a sense of pressure. There is a sense of... And if you're still raising children, which is if you're under 70, I mean, kids don't leave the house today until they're in their mid-40s. I mean, that's a demanding game, baby. I mean, I look at my son. Scott, we share, with Jesse and Mike, we have three boys that are in recovery. And such a blessing. But if you are active with children, there's a dynamic that is, pretty demanding. I always said, having kids is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. It is, I think it takes 125% of whatever you have to raise children. It's one of the great privileges of life. But it's a pretty scary process. It's a process that takes great sacrifice, and it's a process that demands more than you're often willing to give, and sometimes more than you have to give, as does marriage, as does your relationship, anything for a lifetime, your relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. So us older guys, I think, are more interested generally in spirituality and God. That just doesn't have to do with age. There's a lot of old guys that aren't. But one of the reasons, the Hindus divide their life into quartiles. The first quartile is that of a student. Second quartile is that of a householder, work and building your business. Third quartile is leaving the householder. And the fourth quartile is that of a sannyasi. They take a vow of poverty. They have to have their wife's permission to do that, and chastity, and they leave, and they spend the last 20 years of their lives being free to simply be with the power of their understanding. And so for a lot of us who are different quartiles of life, the demands on us are greater. But most of the guys in this room at some level are seekers, or we wouldn't be in this room. And I think if you want something that's going to bring some relief to us in the process of the stress that we're under, be it raising children or doing a business, and today we need a context in which to experience our lives. Part of what's missing today is there is, for many people who are not churched and are not as integrated, they do not have a context to know what kind of men they want to be in their own lives. They would not know how to answer that question. You know, so when I'm working at the sober house, when I'm holding meetings, a lot of these guys, their context is the next day and a half. It is not, they do not have a big box. They're bricklayers. They're not building a cathedral. And if you can somehow broaden that to say what you're going to do, but in the big picture, and try to give them some sort of sense, and this is where I think I've cheated some of the men that I've sponsored in some ways. But when Sandy talked about, you have to some extent, get into the spiritual aspect of it to create the context which brings, as Bill talks about, which brings meaning to the process. Because sobriety is not enough. It's just not enough. I mean, hell, most of us are working pretty damn hard. We've been sober for a considerable period of time. We know it's also mental and emotional. We're doing the very best we know how. And for many of us on a day-to-day basis, it's not enough. So there's only one place that we're going to find the peace that surpasses understanding. The peace that's not in the world. The peace that's not in our head. The wisdom that other men don't have. And that's in a relationship. That's gaining access to the mainframe. That is contacting the God of our understanding. It is a way of knowing that is different than the way of knowing that we generally do anything else. Today, in our world, there is no mystery. I mean, when we, you know, you look at the pornography today. I mean, there's no illusion. You know, it's just a stark presentation, which for, you know, it's pretty stark. In life, in every way, the games that kids play, we have ratcheted up every possible aspect of life to an unsustainable level. And it's assaultive. I mean, there's no censorship anymore. I mean, it is not, you know, there is if you want to have a flag on the, or a cross on the flag of, you know, San Bernardino or something, but there's no censorship anyplace else that we know. So the advantage that we have, and Sandy, you know, when Scott talked about other books, reading other books, I went through, Dr. Bob's daughter, Sue, when I went down to Akron and I went through Dr. Bob's library, was loaded with the sort of books that Sandy has in the back that we're talking about reading. I ended up with 7 or 8 books of Dr. Bob's from his son Bob, and one of the books is Bill is sending Bob for Christmas Jung's book, Man in Search of His Soul, and he says, "Hey, Smitty, read this, great stuff." You know, I mean, it is, you know, and Bill's library was the same thing. They were searchers. But Jung, I think I may be stealing this from Sandy, Jung, when he talked about being able to maintain, so we talk about maintaining our spiritual condition, that our sobriety and our recovery is based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I think it was Jung, one of those guys, talked about the spiritual condition is very difficult, if not impossible, to maintain unless you are in a society that supports it. And we are in such a society. It is astounding. One of the things that's so astounding, I don't think, I don't know when the hell I started talking. Leuvenet, ideally, 5 minutes? One of the things that is so wonderful about us, you know, Christians talk about we're sinners. But as soon as you really start getting your life together and maintain it, the ego starts to get kind of superior about what it knows, and pretty soon they're arguing about theology, you know, the correct interpretation of the book, which we do in Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And when I came in, there were very few people that would hold that book up and make you feel like you were lame if you didn't understand it at the level that they understood it. I mean, if some of those guys showed up in an AA meeting from the 60s, then people throw the hell out of the meeting, I think. I mean, it's just, who does this man think he is that he, you know, thinks he's an expert? You know, because the book's about living life. Does anybody have the arrogance to stand up in a room like this and say, I'm an expert on living life? I mean, that is, I mean, I'm an expert on spiritual awakening. I'm an expert. I'm a fifth level expert in a relationship with a power greater than myself. I mean, one of the reasons we never have arguments about the steps. Have you ever been some? It's extraordinary because we argue about everything else. We argue about the traditions because we have reduced them to rules. We don't often see them as principles. But the steps, almost no one has the arrogance to say, I know. If we use the steps like the traditions, we'd say, what the hell are you doing buying a new car? You haven't finished your amends. I mean, that's not allowed. You can't do that. I mean, be clear about this. We would, have that. And the thing that I think saved our society, because we are a group of rough and tumble, flawed people, is that we share our experience. I don't know where you would go to get a combination of grace, of wisdom, and common sense that you get in our fellowship. There are places that have the grace, and there are places that have the wisdom. But our tradition of having to share only our experience brings an authenticity, brings an integrity to what we say. And we have one of the great BS monitors in AA. There is just something, I mean, we can just hear it. When a guy is talking a little bit above his experience or outside what is really his, you can sense it. Now, almost all of us do that when we first start giving AA talks. We borrow stuff from Sandy or we borrow stuff from Chuck. I mean, that's, you know, but I'm talking about, you can just sense in a room, and we can sit in a room even for an awkward talk that isn't very good, and if it has integrity and it's who that person is, no one gets particularly, but we're with that person and it's just fine. If we get too heady, it's not fine. You know, last week I tried to give a talk, you know, and it was just, my body stayed in the room and whatever should have been with it left. I mean, it is just... And if you're going to give 100 talks, you're going to have two or three like that. You're just going to, and you will be able to know and sense the difference while you're doing it, okay? And so we really need each other. We are almost like a large organism. It's almost like we're cells in a body and that we function and have different things. We clean up different aspects of it, little chemical tests that we do and that we go on, and we help ourselves as a body be healthier than we would be in any sense of the word if we were alone. We don't do well alone. I can do things with someone that I just, you know, I can clean the garage if someone would come over and talk to me. I just can't clean it if no one's there. You know, it just, my wife has been on my ass to clean the bedroom, and I think I'm going to have to invite a sponsee over. But more than anything else, I want to say that none of us are going to be able to walk out of here and do this perfectly. Our ability to understand the discussion we're having this weekend is different for each one of us. It's kind of like a sex education lecture that's given to an entire high school in the upper three grades of grade school. You know, the fifth graders are going to hear it differently than the seniors in high school. So there's a little bit about where we are in our recovery. There's a little bit about how we are as searchers. There's a little bit about, you know, it has to do with personality, and it has to do with maybe a little bit with our backgrounds. But everybody walked out of here knowing a couple of things, that what we're looking for is internal, not external. What we're looking for, we already have. And if there would be one thing that I would like to say, I mean, and it is who we are at our essence. And when we contact that, and all of us contact it in moments at meetings, in moments during talks, at moments walking in the woods, you know, what Rollo May talked about as unitive moments, where there's a feeling of peace and joy that is just astounding. That is available to all of us. And that is what we're looking for. So the sense of dis-ease that we have, which I love that word because that's what we have a dis-ease. The sense of dis-ease we have is due to the separation from who we are in the essence of our very being. And just to the extent, if we would know that, and keep our focus on that, and you're going to lose that focus. I mean, I go days sometimes with forgetting who I am and what my business is. But more than I ever have in my life, I'm connected, and when I feel myself and see myself out of sort, I catch myself up. You see it when the unworkability comes into your life. It is the universe and God saying to you, it's not working, we're not connected, something's wrong. And most of us don't want, we want a different messenger and we don't want that message. So I want to thank Sandy for what he's created here because it's very special. What I love about it is that it's loving and it's gentle and it's right on. God bless. Thanks.